From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for February 14th, 2016. Happy Valentine's Day. This is our weekly look into the politics that shape our lives, so grab that Sunday paper, that hot cup of coffee, and don't forget to put out that vase of roses, and we'll try to get your week off to a rosy start. Well, Dave, there's obviously no shortage of things to talk about this morning. Of course, the stunning announcement yesterday of the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia at the age of 79 and how that affects the presidential race. But first off, I should apologize to everybody who's out there listening. On my way to Springfield on Tuesday evening to hear President Obama address the legislature, I came down with a whopper of a cold. So, yes, thanks, Obama. but this one, it's really been hanging on, and I've tried just about everything to shake it. So if I sound a bit nasal, unlike my usual self, I hope you please understand. I feel like I should have bought stock in Walgreens with everything that I've been buying over there lately. You got any ideas, Dave?
Well, yeah, I do, actually. It's called rest in bed, but there is no such thing in light of everything going on here. And as you mentioned, the death of Supreme Court Justice Scalia just changes all kinds of things here in this final year of President Obama's presidency. And both contenders for the GOP and the Democratic side are talking about what should or should not be done.
Yeah, no, and it was very interesting watching this kind of unfold yesterday. And it was the San Antonio Express News that was the first newspaper to break the story. And just watching the reactions, you have the Republican leaders, the Republicans who control the United States Senate, saying no go. The president can certainly try to make his appointment, but that doesn't mean that the Senate Republicans will allow a ratification vote to take place. You've got the president saying he intends to nominate, and you have the Democratic contenders saying move ahead.
That's part of
the constitutional process.
Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders both speaking at a dinner last night, saying that, reaffirming that the president should indeed move ahead. And with a year left in his term, he certainly will. And, for starters, it's going to be very interesting to see who the nominee might be.
Absolutely. And there's any number of names that are being floated. And, of course, presidents have that file. They have the
ready
file
in hand.
Yes,
yeah.
People that have already been vetted. Even some kind of sketchy reports about the Senate right now is in recess until, I believe, February 22nd. And it's even possible that Obama might try a recess appointment here. Although that also would cause a great deal of consternation as well.
I know you're going to get into this later this morning in the program, Rick, but the fact now that there are eight justices now, any 4-4 decisions, obviously there's no majority opinions on that, and so those would be kind of null and void. Is that right?
Right. Those cases, my understanding is those cases are basically wiped out, and there's some very big cases that are before the court. One of particular interest here in Illinois, it's a case out of California involving the issue of unions and fair share dues payments. And that's basically that if you are, in California, if you're a teacher and you decide you don't want to be a member of the union, you still have to pay what's known as a fair share fee to represent the costs of bargaining and negotiating a contract. And it was actually Justice Scalia who had opened the door towards revisiting previous Supreme Court cases that had upheld the right to pay that fair share due. I say it's of extreme interest in Illinois because that's something that Governor Rauner has been opposed to, actually filed a friend of the court brief in support of overturning those laws requiring fair shares due payment. So that was certainly headed to a 5-4 decision. Now you're likely to see in a number of these cases that have been argued already the case basically will just be remanded. These cases on appeal, they'll stick by whatever the lower court decision is, unable to get a 5-vote majority, if that's the case.
So some of these decisions could be a year away or more.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And obviously, as we watch what unfolds in Washington and the ratification or non-ratification of a new Supreme Court justice, you now move into a presidential season where this could, in essence, be a referenda on how the next Supreme Court should shape, as well as on the presidency itself. So all kinds of things to watch out for. And certainly I'll be taking my fill of cold medicine. I thought you were going to tell me something like, you know, some kind of green tea or something.
Green tea works.
I mean, you've been at this much longer than I have, with all due respect.
No, the green tea does work. I have tried some of these emergency tablets. Zinc actually does. I can remember I was dealing with the makings of a cold and what could have turned into a really intense sore throat. This was a few years ago, and a friend of mine said, go get some zinc tablets, and it worked.
Yeah,
so,
but then you can't go through metal detectors. Right? I'm just asking. I don't know.
Well, just, you know, you just have to take that chance, I guess. You know, they take you aside these days and question you, and you have to, show them the zinc tablets.
Yes, fess up. I was doing some zinc. Yes. Oh, man. Well, we'll make it through the show. Dave's here to keep us up to date on the news, traffic, and weather. Producer Jasmine will be fielding your phone calls. You can give us a call at 312-981-7200. You can text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're also on the Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin and on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is here erecting a wall to keep my cold germs from getting to him. And, of course, as always, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. And you can also get our podcast at iTunes just by searching my name, Rick Pearson. Well, coming up, we've got a great show today. After the 7:30 news, Martha Jo Black joins the show. Martha's a good friend of mine, and she co-authored a memoir of her father, Jo Black, More Than a Dodger. And we'll talk about her book and her celebration of her father, as, of course, we're in Black History Month this month. Then after the 8 o'clock news, we're going to talk to my Tribune colleague, John Byrne. John's part of our political team at the paper, and he covered a pretty wild session of the city council last week with some aldermen apparently kind of feeling their oats about Mayor Rahm Emanuel's weakened public posture as reflected in our recent Tribune polls. And then after the 8:30 news update, my good friend Christopher Mooney joins the show. Chris is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. We'll talk about the presidential race, Justice Scalia's death. We'll also talk about President Obama's visit to Springfield. Well, that's all coming up, but first we're going to take a quick break. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and it's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And, of course, today is dominated by the political ramifications over the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley of Iowa, of the Republican majority in the Senate, they're saying no Obama nominee should be confirmed. But the president intends to make a pick.
It is difficult to in any way argue with the goal that we both share, but I think the American people deserve to know specifically how this would work. We should not make promises we can't keep.
Secretary Clinton, you're not in the White House yet.
We've had like 200 presidential primary debates, And this is the first time there have been a majority of women on the stage.
I think a Sanders victory would be of some historical accomplishment as well.
I think we're in vigorous agreement here.
So race relations would be better under a Sanders presidency than they've been.
Right, absolutely.
I want to talk to you about white people. Okay?
White people.
I know.
People aren't dumb. Why in God's name does Wall Street make huge campaign contributions? I guess just for the fun of it. She talked about getting the approval or the support or the mentoring of Henry Kissinger. Count me in as somebody who will not be listening to Henry Kissinger.
Journalists have asked who you do listen to on foreign policy, and we have yet to know who that is.
Well, it ain't Henry Kissinger.
Today, Senator Sanders said that President Obama failed the presidential leadership test. He's called him weak. He's called him a disappointment. I don't think he gets the credit he deserves.
Madam Secretary, that is a low blow. One of us ran against Barack Obama. I was not that candidate.
Those were some of the highlights of last week's Democratic debate between Bernie Sanders and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Sanders, who heavily defeated Clinton in New Hampshire, is starting to feel some momentum, and the Clinton forces are working hard to respond. Here's Bernie Sanders' aspirational ad in which he emphasizes terms like we and us and together.
Our job is not to divide. Our job is to bring people together. If we do not allow them to divide us up by race, by sexual orientation, by gender, by not allowing them to divide us up by whether or not we were born in America or whether we're immigrants, when we stand together as white, black, and Hispanic, and gay, and straight, and woman, and man, when we stand together and demand that this country works for all of us rather than the few, we will transform America. And that is what this campaign is about. It's bringing people together.
Now, as I said, Hillary Clinton is fighting back. She was endorsed by the Congressional Black Caucus, with African Americans an important voting constituency in South Carolina. But more than just being endorsed, civil rights icon and Congressman John Lewis said he's never met Bernie Sanders.
To be very frank, I don't want to cut you off, but I never saw him.
Uh-oh.
I never met him. I was chair of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee for 3 years, from 1963 to 1966. I was involved in the sit-ins, the Freedom Rally, the March on Washington, the March from Selma to Montgomery, and directed a voter education project for 6 years. But I met Hillary Clinton. I met President Clinton.
Now, Lewis has walked back that comment just a bit and says he's not questioning Sanders' commitment to the cause of civil rights. Sanders also appeared on Late Night with Stephen Colbert, and Colbert asked the Vermont senator an interesting question. Doesn't it seem that Sanders supporters and Donald Trump supporters may have something in common?
Well, I think a lot of Donald Trump's supporters are angry. They're, in many cases, people who are working longer hours for low wages. Mm-hmm. They're people who are really worried about what's going to happen to their kids. But I think what they have done is responded to Trump's false message, which suggests that if we keep Muslims out of this country, or if we keep scapegoating Latinos or Mexicans, that somehow our country becomes better. I think that's a false solution. And my view is that, yes, people have a right to be angry. You have a right to be angry when we are the only major country on earth that doesn't provide paid family and medical leave. When we have more people living in poverty today than almost any time in the history of this country. People have a right to be angry. But what we need to be is rational in figuring out how we address the problems and not simply scapegoating minorities.
Now, as I mentioned, Hillary Clinton is working hard to get the black vote in South Carolina, and she'll also be in Bronzeville on Wednesday here in Chicago. She's got a new ad which features the widower of the Charleston church shooting as she comes to a reoccurring campaign theme, her support of gun control.
Somebody called me on the phone. She said, Reverend Thompson? I said, yeah.
She said, "They're shooting around the church." And I just dropped the phone. First thing came to my mind was, we need to make some changes. Hillary is really committed to making sure that the guns don't get into the wrong hands. And is standing with the president to get stronger gun laws. So no family ever has to go through anything like this again.
I'm Hillary Clinton, and I approve this message.
We'll have more of our spin through national politics coming up. Right now, though, it's time for a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, my friend Martha Jo Black, author of Joe Black, More Than a Dodger.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Happy Valentine's Day. It's I was just out on the WGN Storm Center patio, and it's still a little bit brisk out there on this Sunday morning, but it's at least sunny, and enjoy it before the snow begins to fall, as you heard from Dave's forecast. Well, we had a bit of an audio mix-up when we started the show, but as I said, today is a day being dominated by the discussion of the political ramifications over the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And you already have Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader from Kentucky. You have Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley of Iowa. Both of them are saying that Republicans will not consider a nominee from President Obama to be confirmed, that it should be a decision for the next president. Nevertheless, President Obama intends to make a pick.
Today is a time to remember Justice Scalia's legacy. I plan to fulfill my constitutional responsibilities to nominate a successor in due time. There will be plenty of time for me to do so and for the Senate to fulfill its responsibility to give that person a fair hearing and a timely vote. These are responsibilities that I take seriously, as should everyone. They're bigger than any one party. They are about our democracy. They're about the institution to which Justice Scalia dedicated his professional life, and making sure it continues to function as the beacon of justice that our founders envisioned.
That's the president speaking yesterday about the death of Antonin Scalia. Now, of course, the issue of Scalia's death quickly became a topic of last night's Republican presidential debate. Here is Ted Cruz and Donald Trump.
The reason principle matters, sadly, was illustrated by the first questions today. The next president is going to appoint 1, 2, 3, 4 Supreme Court justices. If Donald Trump is president, he will appoint liberals. If Donald Trump is president, your Second Amendment will go away.
Hold on, before,
you know how I know that?
Hold on, gentlemen, I'm going to turn this far around.
John Roberts, Ted Cruz, with your brother, wanted John Roberts to be in the United States Supreme Court. They both pushed him. He twice approved Obamacare.
All right, gentlemen.
Good going, man.
So there's a sampling of the sparks that flew during last night's Republican debate. Just a reminder, we've got 6 days to go until the South Carolina Republican primary and the Nevada Democratic caucuses, 9 days till Nevada's Republican caucuses, and 13 days to the South Carolina Democratic primary. So the schedule is getting very accelerated very quickly here. Well, joining me now here in the Showcase studio is Martha Jo Black. And Martha's my good friend. And she's also author of a memoir, biography of her father, Jo Black, More Than a Dodger. And I think, Martha, you were here when the book first came out.
Yes, this was actually my first radio show, January 25th. Yes, at 46, I still remember certain dates. So yeah, you were
That was a memorable date.
Yes, it was. And I also remember in the studio, you guys had specific donuts stuffed with bacon and stuff.
Oh.
That day.
That could very well be.
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of interesting. And I gained like at least 4 pounds before I left.
See, the only radio show that you gain weight from.
Yes. But I appreciate it. Well, my dad was very happy that you did that for me.
Well, it is African-American History Month, and this book actually, I thought it was fantastic, and not
Thank
because
you.
You're a friend, but because I viewed it as educational, because, you know, we have this whole generation. I mean, you heard we played that cut of Congressman John Lewis.
Right.
And, you know, the whole issue of civil rights and those kinds of things. And, you know, it's not that far distant, but yet you have this whole generation, I guess, maybe in a good way, that do not see things the way those of us who went through it.
I somewhat agree with that. I mean, you have to keep in mind, granted, I did not go through any of that. I'm from Paradise Valley, Arizona. Hello. Very Republican, very when are we going to the mall kind of state. But in the same token, my dad would be 92 years old at this point. My dad was a pallbearer at Dr. King's funeral. And so he had me go to a black college so I can understand what it does mean to be black. And I'm a big believer, because of my father raising me, which is like a grandfather, that sometimes you have to know your past to know where you need to go in your future. You have to respect where people, what people have done for you to get where you are. It's not about having new cell phones and being famous and stuff like that. It's about working hard and doing things for other people. And I think that we've somewhat lost that. I think Black History Month, if Stacey Dash would say that we shouldn't have that, but then if that's the case, then we shouldn't have anybody being, we shouldn't have, who cares about St. Patrick's Day? Who cares about these other things? I mean, we celebrate people. We don't live in utopia. So you do have to respect what people have gone through. And I think there was a sincere struggle. And we have come far from that, but we're not that far gone from it.
No, we're not that far gone from it. And there's still a much a long road ahead.
Exactly.
Too. And by understanding the past, I think you have a better understanding of, you know,
where you need to go.
Exactly.
And how you need to help people. I mean, it was something my dad saying was, I am my brother's keeper. That had nothing to do with race. That means if I can help you, I would be there to help you. And I don't think very many people do that right now in this society, period. I mean, I work for a sports team. And, you know, right now, no new generations about you're on your cell phone all the time. You're looking at that. Do people know how to communicate anymore? And I think when you miss that communication, that is why things go the way that they are. So I think that's something huge that this whole country has to get better at, with communicating with one another to respect what happened previously so you can move forward, because your cell phone won't do it for you.
Your father, and we talked about this a while back, the column that he had.
By the way. Mm-hmm.
That ran, I think it was in Ebony.
Yeah, Ebony and Jet Magazine, and he did a lot on black radio, like WVON and stuff like that, and the Defender newspaper as well here. And he
would catch some grief over some
things. A lot of grief, yes. A great deal, yes. As I learned when I went to school in Atlanta at Spelman, they were like, oh, you know, people here don't really like your dad. And I was like, right. I had no idea what that was coming from. But it is definitely something that my dad got grief from, because he said, you have to work hard. You should be very proud of who you are. I think during the time when I was a child, and so I didn't experience any of this, a lot of African-Americans wore dashikis to work and stuff like that. Well, they were upset that they weren't getting promoted within their job. And my dad's like, well, you can't dress like that. You have to blend in with where you're working, but you still should be very proud. Being proud of being black means that maybe you're helping that little boy next to you go to church, or maybe you're taking him to baseball practice. You're doing something. You have to give back. And a lot of African Americans during that time used to send my dad death threats, besides on himself and on me as well. And it's funny, one of my friends sent me a Jet magazine, which I will definitely bring to you so you can see that my parents' divorce was in Jet magazine in 1975. And stated that my father won custody of me. And I was like, we are so not a Kardashian. Why was this in there? You know, I mean, it was just, it's very strange. When I saw that, I was like, this is from a magazine, Jet magazine from 1975. And both my parents' pictures are in there. And I was like, we are so dysfunctional. It was just very strange to see something like that. But it's definitely, I think we don't have anybody speaking about the black community really in a positive light right now. And as you know, as I said to you many of day, that I wanted to do this book because my father was an amazing father to me, not because of baseball, that he lived his dream, but education was very important. And it took my dad 8 years to graduate college.
And we're going to talk more about that in just a moment, because the rationale for doing the book, I think, I mean, in respect, I kind of call it for Valentine's Day, it's a love story.
Yes.
About a daughter's feelings towards her father. We're speaking with Martha Jo Black, author of Joe Black, More Than a Dodger. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. And here with me in the Allstate Showcase studio at Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue is Martha Jo Black, author of Joe Black, More Than a Dodger. And Martha, it's funny because we know each other so well. We just started talking about your dad without kind of maybe, you know, perhaps like explaining what the title means. Okay.
Yes. Well, the title of the book is Jerry Reinsdorf, who is my boss. I do work for the Chicago White Sox. That he thought of it because my father did so much more than just play for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Regardless, he got traded to Cincinnati Reds and played for the Washington Senators as well. But my dad lived his dream. He was Rookie of the Year in 1952, first black pitcher to win a World Series game. And I did not know that my father was also the first vice president of a transportation corporation for Greyhound Corporation early on until he passed away. And because my dad never explained any of that to me. But so my dad did a lot, living out his dream with baseball, and then went into corporate America to write the commentaries, as you mentioned, like, by the way, in Ebony and Jet magazine, to help people in the black community, in any community. Anytime it came to education, my dad was wholeheartedly wanted to help somebody and lend a helping hand. I mean, heck, my dad paid for my boyfriend in college. Morehouse lost his financial aid, and my dad paid for his second year at Morehouse College.
I mean, education for him was always a fundamental.
Yes, that was the first thing over everything. It doesn't matter about sports. You should definitely live your dream. I think a lot of young people, and especially a lot of African-American parents, they talk about how black men don't play baseball anymore. Well, think about it. If you come up with a middle-class family, rich family, whichever, your kid wants to play baseball, you're like, honey, you may not make it. So why don't you just worry about school and do that, because that's something you can definitely rely on. I definitely agree with that. But in the same token, I think more parents should be saying, well, go for your dream, but you definitely have to get that education. When you're playing Major League Baseball, regardless of what nationality you are, you can go back to school in the offseason. You make enough money to pay for college, and none of them do.
Yeah, and I mean, you see, as I do, so much about professional sports and all that big money and the contracts and stuff, as people kind of, as younger minority people looking at, that's my gateway out.
Right,
It's like, but it's a lottery ticket.
It's definitely a lottery ticket, and I think that it's not a bad lottery to play in, but you definitely have to get your education to fall back on, because once that game is over, my dad played for 5 years. If he didn't have an education, my dad could have never been the senior vice president of Greyhound Corporation. There are a lot of former players that are in the Hall of Fame that are begging to work for a team somehow, some way. There's only so many radio and TV jobs for the Cubs as well as the White Sox that are available. So not everybody could work there. I mean, I love my Uncle Ernie Banks, one of your favorite players from back in the day. He did stuff for the Cubs, but he wasn't making a lot of money with them.
Right.
You know, in that sense. You know, so they have to substitute their income somehow in some way.
Well, and your dad was very important player in with Major League Baseball,
yes,
too.
Yes, my dad as was far as a consultant for MLB. He helped start the Major League Baseball assistance team, BAT, to help former players, Negro League players and umpires, and anybody in the baseball family that comes on hard times. Because we unfortunately know that health issues and cancer seems to be in everybody's life. Those are very expensive to deal with. And so BAT will help fundamentally to pay for certain things that you can't pay for.
We've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning, Rick. You know, I usually call in with some political stuff, but this is really, baseball is my number one passion. So I will definitely.
It's a bigger passion for you than politics?
Oh, I love it.
It's more fun.
And I wanted to just really ask, are you still a baseball fan? I go to the Negro Baseball Museum in Kansas City.
It's a fantastic place.
Time.
Yes.
And I think Jerry Reinsdorf does a whole lot as far as giving to our community. But I just wanted to ask you, are you a big baseball fan, and where do you see African Americans participating and hoping that they'll get back into baseball? Rick, thanks again for having on, and I definitely want to pick up the book. You all have a great day.
All right, thank you, Ron.
No, thank you. To answer those questions, yes, Jerry Reinsdorf does a lot in the community of all of Chicago. I will definitely tell you that I do believe I love baseball. I've been going to baseball. My dad, when I'm from Arizona, we would go to Dodger Stadium a lot. I met Dusty Baker when he was a player and I was a child. So I definitely think a lot of African Americans will play. I would hope they would play. There is no instant gratification, though, because there's single A, double A, and triple A, and then you hope you can get to the majors, versus a lot of African Americans play football and basketball because it's instant. They will take you from high school to go there versus Major League Baseball wants you to get some type of education, and they push that more forward into that for African Americans. But I think I answered most of your questions. I'm not sure. I can tell you that you can buy the book on Amazon.com, and it was at Barnes & Noble, but I definitely know you can buy it on Amazon.
Well, and your father was so highly thought of that you've got, I mean, he's there, you were out part of, and as well as promoting the book, as the couple of awards that are presented in his name. The I think there's one at the Most Valuable Player from the Arizona Fall League.
Yeah, the Arizona Fall League. They're a player that was actually a White Sox player that just won the award this past year from the Arizona Fall League. That was my first job in Major League Baseball in 1992. And a lot of Major League Baseball's done a lot. Like I said, Bat has done a lot for my father. A lot of my father's friends, Peter O'Malley and everybody, they do a great deal in honor of my father. And obviously I work for my dad's friend, Mr. Reinsdorf, so Jerry gets to have me as a pain to remind him of my father, since I look so much like my dad.
Well, and just real quickly, once again, the story, one of the best stories in the book is the fact that, you know, going to high school in New Jersey, race was never really an issue.
Right.
Playing baseball, scouts are there. They look at all the white kids, and he wonders why.
They're not looking at him, and he asked actually one of the scouts, and he was like, so I think I'm pretty good. The scouts, who were obviously all Caucasian then, were like, oh, you're really, really good. He's like, so why aren't you talking to me? He's like, oh, because color guys don't play. My dad's like, what? Because my dad never paid attention, and playing for New Jersey, if they were all poor, they all played together. There was no race. He did not understand that there was – he understood there was segregation, but it wasn't that apparent in front of him. And my dad went home after that and ripped up all his baseball cards because he never paid attention that they were all Caucasian.
Except for one.
Hank Greenberg, his favorite player.
Which had his own form of
– racism.
As a Jewish player.
Yeah. I mean, Sandy Koufax went through that. I mean, when it comes to certain holidays, they didn't want to play, and they're very respectful, and people didn't understand that, and that's very unfair.
Well, again, Martha, it's a fantastic book, and I think it's well worth a read. And frankly, it's an enjoyable read, but also, as I said, it's a very educational read. And as you said, you got to know where you came from to see where you're going.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think it's a good read, and I hope people enjoy it. And the book has a lot of baseball in it, and my voice is italicized within the book, and that is because that shows my love and respect for my father.
That's Martha Jo Black, author of Joe Black, More Than a Dodger, and you can pick that up at Amazon.com. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with my Tribune colleague, member of the Tribune's political team, John Byrne, as we discuss last week's action or inaction at the Chicago City Council.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. Happy Valentine's Day again. So it's a gentle nudge-nudge reminder there in case you haven't done your proper duties out there. Bright and sunny today, but chilly, and snow is on its way. You know, one of the more interesting things in political news last week occurred when California Republican Representative Duncan Hunter was caught vaping during a congressional hearing. Vaping in a congressional hearing. Here's Congressman Hunter's explanation.
This is called a vaporizer. There's no combustion. There's no carcinogens. What the gentlelady did not say is that smoking has gone down as the use of vaporizers has gone up. There is no burning. There's nothing noxious about this whatsoever. This has helped thousands of people quit smoking. It's helped me quit smoking. And in the next decade or so, you're going to be able to inhale ibuprofen. You're going to be able to inhale your Prozac and anything else that you need drug-wise, you're going to be able to inhale it.
I think there's already a different kind of inhaling going on in Washington. Also in political news, odd political news, Texas Senator Ted Cruz's campaign announced that it had pulled an ad that was kind of a playoff, recovering voters disappointed in candidate promises. Well, Cruz pulled the ad because the woman that you'll hear was featured, the woman featured in it, she had appeared in softcore porn films. Here's that ad.
Has anyone else here struggled with being lied to?
Well, I voted for a guy who was a Tea Party hero on the campaign trail, and then he went to D.C. and played patty cake with Chuck Schumer and cut a deal on amnesty.
Does that make you angry?
Angry? Makes me feel dumb for trusting him.
Maybe you should vote for more than just a pretty face next time.
You guys have room for one more? Come on in. Come on in.
Come on in. You can have Frank's chair.
I'm Ted Cruz, and I approve this message.
Obviously, Senator Cruz does not approve of that message anymore. Well, joining me now in the Allstate Showcase studio is my Tribune colleague, a member of the Tribune's political team, John Byrne. And, John, thanks for getting up for me this morning.
Sure.
I know it's never easy, but...
No, my pleasure. Happy Valentine's Day.
And to you. And it was quite an eventful city council meeting and hearings over this past week.
Yeah.
As it seemed like some of these city council members were seizing upon the public support weakness with Rahm Emanuel. Is that a fair assessment?
You know, there was definitely a lot of sound and fury in city council, much more so than we're used to seeing from a group of aldermen who, by and large, mostly get in line when they're told. But, you know, at the end of the day, we'll see on some of these things how much it actually turns out to be a true revolt and how much it's just a little bit of chest puffing and they may cave in the end.
Well, one of these issues, and we actually had somebody from a few weeks back from the Retail Merchants Association, the issue of the tobacco tax, non-cigarette tobacco tax,
right.
And their concerns over the issue of a minimum cigarette pricing as
right.
part of this. And the city setting a minimum pricing level. But the whole idea of this tobacco tax didn't go exactly the way that Mayor Emanuel had planned it to go.
Yeah, no, this has been an issue that for him has been a trustworthy issue for him to get on these tobacco taxes, frame it as a prevention crusade. It's a crusade to prevent childhood smoking. And there have been a couple of times in the past where he's passed these taxes and you know, publicly bullied aldermen into getting on board because he wanted 45 yes votes. He wanted these overwhelming shows of support for these things in the past, and this time it was a tax he wanted to put on chewing tobacco, cigars, and roll your own tobacco. So not cigarettes, but he also wanted to raise the minimum age. You'd have to be 21 to buy any tobacco in the city of Chicago. And first, the Finance Committee balked at it with a lot of aldermen complaining about the effect on retailers, especially near the edges of the city, said that that there's already a whole lot of illegal sales of Lucy cigarettes in a lot of neighborhoods, and what's the city going to do about that? And there was also some complaining about the idea if you can send a guy to war
at 18, right.
Let him buy a cigarette, so the mayor, as he does, he sort of tweaked it around the edges. He said, well, here's what we'll do. We'll pledge to spend some of this money, that it's only gonna be $6 million that they're predicting it'll raise every year, spend some of the money on cessation programs, and then we'll toughen up on this sale of illegal Lucy cigarettes. All right, everybody, so here we go. I've made some concessions. Let's get on board. And then it came to the council, and a couple of aldermen stood up and said, no, we're going to use this this procedural move, and we're going to delay it for a month. So I think, based on Emanuel's reaction to that move, I'm guessing that it's got to come up again next month. The procedural move only buys the opponents a month to try to pull people back
right.
into the no column. And the mayor came out afterward and, you know, very, very indignant that, that they took this move. They can delay this, but they can't defer the future. This is the good of the children of Chicago. My mother struggled with smoking. We're going to lead the way on this. We're going to be back. They can't stop us. Based on how indignant he was, I'm guessing that next month it comes up. He gets the votes he needs, and it passes
without any further tweaking of it.
I'm guessing he had the votes. Maybe there'll be a little more tweaking, but I'm betting he had the votes, and they're not going to be able, the opponents won't be able to pull enough people into the no column to stop it from passing next month. I would think.
Now there is this kind of, as I understand, and it's something the retailers pointed out, this kind of fallback of.
Right. So the thing, the problem is, and you may know more about this than me, is that state law doesn't allow municipalities to have their own taxes on chewing tobacco. They allow municipalities, state law allows municipalities to have their own cigarette taxes, and Chicago has the highest cigarette taxes in the United States. But the city council just decided that, well, they've been, some aldermen have been working to try to get lawmakers to pass a bill
enabling
the chewing tobacco thing. Of course, nothing's getting done in Springfield, so they just decided, well, we're going to go ahead and pass this tax. But then the city ordinance contains this weird language that says if a lawsuit is successful, and this chewing tobacco tax and the cigar tax and the roll your own tax are knocked down by a court, in that case, then immediately what will kick in is minimum pricing. So you would have to charge, if you're a retailer, at least X amount for chewing tobacco per ounce, at least X amount per cigar, and at least X amount per ounce of roll your own. And they're saying, so this would take the place of the tax. We would bump up all these prices, mandate pricing, and prevent youth chewing tobacco use that way, I guess. So I've never seen anything like that.
And of course that's the issue, and the while they stop short of saying they would file a lawsuit, the retailers are saying,
yeah,
you know, you start mandating certain minimum pricing on products,
where does it stop? How can we trust? I talked to Tanya Trish from the retail merchants, and she said, you can't trust the city of Chicago to be setting prices. If they're going to set prices on this, what are they going to set prices on next? If we don't stand up and stop them on this minimum pricing idea, then what else are they going to decide they need to legislate to make it too expensive for regular Chicagoans to buy? We can't let this nanny state thing take effect. And she said it's ripe. She used the term ripe for a lawsuit.
I mean, there's never a dull moment when it comes to the city of Chicago. We're speaking with John Byrne, my Tribune colleague. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. This is the Sunday Spin. Eight 20 on this Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson. Valentine's Day Sunday here in Chicago. I'm in the Allstate Showcase studio, and joining me here is my good friend and colleague, John Byrne, part of the Tribune's political team. We're talking about last week's goings-on at the Chicago City Council, and John, I have to think that some of the rhetoric was largely due to the poll numbers that the Tribune came out with that showed a lot of weakness here for Rahm Emanuel. His favorability, 21%, unfavorability, 57%, job approval, 27% approve, 63% disapprove. Particularly troubling for him, I would suppose, in the African-American community, kind of further fallout of the Laquan McDonald shooting video handling incident. Job approval in the African-American community, 20%.
Yeah.
71% disapprove. You go down the line, the mayor's handling of crime, do you approve or disapprove? 19% approve, 70% disapprove.
Yeah.
You look into whether you believe the mayor on why the video wasn't released. Was he justified? 21% yes, 68% no. Do you believe him when he says he didn't see the video? 17% yes, 74% no.
And I don't think, you know, it's not based on everything we've been hearing and just the general feeling, the mood in the city. I don't think it's shocking that these numbers weren't good for the mayor. But, man, to see them laid out that starkly is that's something else.
Well, that's it. It's you know, it's one of those things where we can we feel something in our gut and anecdotally.
Yeah.
But when you actually do the data and see those numbers.
And put him in he has been in the past several weeks, he and his administration have been making the case sort of publicly and his administration quietly that we're past the worst of this, you know, and he's talking about we're moving forward and his people are saying, you know, we're not seeing thousands of people on Michigan Avenue anymore. People aren't marching around City Hall anymore. Things are sort of getting back.
Well, and he's been doing some quiet back channel outreach.
Sure. And he's been doing a lot of, he's been meeting with people, he's been meeting with African American leaders, and now all of a sudden then these poll numbers come out, and suddenly he's back to just basically, he's back on his heels a little bit. He was having to justify himself in terms of the Laquan McDonald situation all over again, and the fact that people aren't getting past this, Mr. Mayor. This is still a lot of people are very angry with a lot of stuff here, and so he tried to sort of pivot on this and say, well, it's not about a snapshot in time in regard to the poll numbers. It's not about this snapshot. This has clearly been some trying couple months. And then he kind of went into statesman mode and said, this is about my job is to position the city for the future. And we're not going to talk about what's happening right at this moment. I'll be judged on whether the city of Chicago is being positioned well for to be a city of the future and to win the future. And then he goes into talking points about education and things like that.
Yeah, but also, you know, his numbers were upside down on his handling of the schools. Once again, as our previous polls have shown, more people side with the teachers union than they side with him. You have this turmoil kind of going on involving Chicago Public Schools and the teachers union over a new contract.
Yeah.
Plus the whole issue of the funding of public schools, the fact that the $725 million bond sale went at 8.75% interest.
Yikes.
Yeah, a pretty good investment if you want to bet the risk. But, I mean, nevertheless, some very troubling times for him.
Yeah.
Also in council was the issue of Inspector General and oversight of the city council. Can you briefly walk us through this? Because I have to tell you, no offense, but I'm still confused by it.
I'm still confused by it, too, frankly. And from the mayor's perspective, the mayor has been, like incredibly hands-off about this whole thing for a long time, you know, and is just repeatedly said, well, we're going to have something. And basically, there's going to be some sort of oversight here. But what it is, he's going to let those guys
figure it out.
Let the aldermen figure it out. And then we all get to concentrate on the fact that the aldermen are a bunch of, you know, are protecting themselves. And the focus isn't so much on the mayor anymore. He's probably happy that this all went down this week because it's
look over here.
Demonize them.
Yes, exactly.
Demonize them. So some aldermen have put forward an ordinance that came up last month in the city council that would have basically given Inspector General Joseph Ferguson, who's the IG for the rest of city government, including the mayor's office, would have given him the same power to look into claims of wrongdoing and given him auditing capabilities in the city council. So it would have, if somebody said, well, this alderman is breaking the law, they could make a complaint and he could look into that. And he would have been able to do things like look at
audit their menu money,
which is just
the little pot of money that they get.
Each alderman gets every year, and they can use it on potholes or whatever. But some of the time, they're using it to rent office space from their brothers-in-law, and they're leasing Cadillac Escalades and things like that that aren't maybe necessarily illegal, but makes them look bad, right?
Right.
Using this public money, and really, should you be renting this office space from your sister's next door neighbor, you know? So when this came up last month, a couple of very powerful aldermen, Ed Burke from the 14th ward and Kerry Austin from the 34th ward, who have been strong opponents of giving Ferguson any kind of oversight, they used a procedural move to delay that vote until this month. And then when it came up this month, they introduced a substitute ordinance that gave Ferguson the ability to look into claims of wrongdoing. If you say if somebody makes a complaint, Ferguson could look into that, but it stripped him of the auditing power. So he would no longer have the ability to go in and look at the menu money or the workers' comp fund, which is this massive $100 million fund that Burke's Finance Committee controls. And so there was it broke out very starkly as sort of these self-styled reformers standing up in city council last week saying, look, we can't take a half measure here. We've got to go all the way. We've got to hold ourselves to the same standard as the rest of city government. But then there were others who said, well, we can't let Ferguson, you know, this idea that Ferguson could engage in witch hunts against aldermen and that people could use this for political purposes to go after aldermen when there wasn't really any reason to. So this amended version that took away the auditing power came up, and it was a really, really, really close vote. We were counting the votes as they went through in city council. There were two aldermen absent, and it ended up being 25 votes in favor of the weaker, watered-down version and 23 votes in favor of keeping, of not watering it down. And then the watered-down version passed.
And so as a result, even though we're always told follow the money, Joe Ferguson doesn't get to follow the money.
Ferguson won't be able to go in and audit things in city council, correct?
That's my colleague John Byrne from our Tribune political team keeping an eye out on what's going on at City Hall. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Policy at the University of Illinois. We'll be talking about presidential politics, the death of Supreme Court Justice Scalia, as well as President Obama's visit to Springfield last week.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Brisk day out there, still, the sun makes it kind of nice out there, and get outside for a little bit. Do something before the snow hits. And at least the temperatures aren't as bad as what's going on in New York and New England with the wind chills out there. Well, joining me on the phone is my good friend Christopher Mooney. He's director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. And, Chris, when we set this up, we didn't know how the dramatic change I think we're going to be seeing in the presidential campaign now, as I said earlier, almost a referendum on the next shape of the Supreme Court.
Well, that's true. It seems like a shock, but Scalia was 79 years old and way overweight, and we're shocked to find that the guy died in his sleep. So people on the Supreme Court, several of them are very old. This is going to happen. And I think the fact that we haven't had this in a little while is lulled people to sleep. But it's always thus, right? I mean, there's always somebody on the Supreme Court either retiring or dying, it seems like, every few years. And that really it's funny to say that this really shows why the presidential election is important. yes, I think the presidential election is important, but this is another point in that regard.
It puts it more in focus. It puts it more directly in front of voters, I think. You and I know, obviously, all that's entailed in the powers of the presidency, but just the stark suddenness of Scalia's death kind of puts this at the forefront of voters' minds. I don't know if there's a retention value of that, although I guess we will see, depending on you basically have the camps acting predictably. You have the Republicans saying we're not going to ratify any pick that President Obama makes, that it should be the next president to decide. And certainly you have Obama saying, I'm going ahead and I'm going to have a nominee, and Democratic contenders for the presidency saying, yeah, it's what government does. The president proposes and the legislature needs to act.
Right. I mean, the president has an obligation to make a nomination. It's a year out. It's going to be a strategic move, obviously. Obama has to think, well, what what do I want to do here? Do I want to throw up someone who's, you know, very liberal that has no chance of getting through but can, you know, can rally the base for the Democratic ticket in the fall? Or do I try to put somebody up there who is hard for the Senate to say no to? I have a feeling that's what he'll do. I mean, Obama is naturally a centrist, and you know, that's sort of his inclination. I think that he, you know, he'll find someone, possibly someone who's already just been approved by the Senate, which is always, that's always a, you know, that's a tried and true tactic, right? If they, hey, you just approved him for this, why aren't you going to approve him for that?
Right. If you were good once, yeah, you can, you're good for all, always kind of thing.
Exactly. And somebody who's, I mean, it's going to be tough. Whoever it's going to be is going to get raked over the coals. It's going to be rough. But, you know, it's probably the best thing for the president to do for the presidency, and certainly tactically, politically, to get out there and put somebody up that if that person doesn't get approved, that at least it gives them some political leverage in the fall.
I thought it was kind of interesting in the debate last night, and we played a clip of it, of Ted Cruz warning that a Donald Trump presidency would mean the appointment of liberal justices, and Trump shooting back at Cruz, and also to Jeb Bush and his brother, George W. Bush, for appointing John Roberts, who twice has upheld the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare.
Yeah, well, not to mention Souter, who I think the Republicans still hold that against, or the conservatives still hold that against George H.W. Bush for appointing that guy. I mean, you never know how people are going to react when they get onto the Supreme Court. So they're, you know, famous, you know, John Paul Stevens was appointed by Jerry Ford, and he was one of the classic liberals on the court.
Earl Warren.
At least what passes for a liberal. Earl Warren, right? White Eisenhower said it was his most, it was his worst mistake, right? With to say it something, if you talk about being a president for 8 years, that's the worst thing you should do. So, and there's going to be other ones. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, she looks like she's on life support, you know, we'll see. One of the problems on this is that you've got, you know, for a long time now, it's just been coincidental that when a Republican, was president, the Supreme Court nominee or justices who retired or died were the conservatives, and when the Democrat was president, they tended to be the liberals, and therefore you didn't change the balance of power, really. This has the potential to change the balance of power. And, you know, and Scalia, you know, love him or hate him, he is one of the most brilliant legal minds ever sit on the court. I think history will show that. And he has been an icon for the conservative movement. He's, you know, Ronald Reagan's last nominee. And, you know, he's a person that really looms large symbolically for the conservative movement.
Actually, I like in one of the dissents of that, of one of the Affordable Care Act, I think it was in the second time that the Supreme Court upheld it, he mocked the majority for as engaging in, quote, interpretive jiggery-pokery, unquote.
And yeah, he was a funny guy. We're not going to see that again for a while, probably.
And he said that the court had gone to such extraordinary lengths to save the Affordable Care Act that, quote, we should start calling this law SCOTUS care, which...
Yes, right. He had a wicked sense of humor, that which came from, I think, an intellectual self-confidence. He was very smart. He knew he was very smart. He was probably always the smartest guy in any room he appeared in, including in the deliberation chambers of the Supreme Court, which is saying a heck of a lot. And so he felt comfortable enough in his own skin that he could, you know, go out there. And as time went on, especially in recent years, he's really gone. You know, he went far out there that way.
We've got a call from Mike. Mike, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yes, how you gentlemen doing this morning?
Very well, thank you.
Hi, Rick. Big fan of yours, and I appreciate your show every Sunday morning. Yeah, I just wanted to say that the lame duck session doesn't technically start until the day after the presidential election, until the third week of January. So the statement that Mitch McConnell made last night saying that, you know, if the president goes ahead and makes a nomination and, you know, he could go ahead and do that, but that doesn't necessarily mean they have to bring it up for a vote, then that's fine. Because I think the way it's going to go down is it's going to backfire on the Republicans. You're going to have mass protests in the street during the summer, especially during the conventions on both sides. And you're going to have all these people calling Congress and their senators, well, not the Congress, but the U.S. senators, to say, we demand a vote. And I guarantee you, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, either one of them don't want this to be their issue. They just want the president to move on and do his job, make a nomination, make an appointment, and then let it go down to the U.S. Senate for a vote.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. I mean, that's the question I have, is how much political staying power there will be in all of this. Chris?
Well, it's always a spin issue, right? Who's going to, I mean, who's going to, how are they going to jigger up the discussion on this? And that'll be down to the candidates and to the various interest groups involved and the parties involved. I think this plays into the hand in the Republican primary of Ted Cruz. Because he is the true conservative. I mean, he is, you know, he is true blue to the conservative movement. At least that's his brand. And I think more so than any of the other candidates currently on the stage, with the possible exception of Marco Rubio, though he's got his own issues at the moment. And so if the conservatives and conservative movement is very focused in recent years on the U.S. Constitution, which is strict
constitutionalist attitudes. Yes.
You know, sort of Straussian, looking at particular words and what do they mean and so forth, and not extrapolating to the modern circumstance and trying to interpret in terms of what was going on in 1787? What did this happen? You know, so I think this plays to his hand, especially because they feel like they were burned by George H.W. Bush. And to some extent by George Bush, you know, with Roberts, again, the two decisions that you mentioned, though I don't think anybody would consider him a flaming liberal. That helps him. Especially if the president is strategic and picks someone, for example, someone of a community that Democrats can rile up in some sense to motivate either their base to get them out to vote or split the other side. It might be valuable for them. So it is interesting. I mean, 24 hours after this guy's death, that we don't know how it's going to play out, but it certainly has the potential to impact the campaign significantly.
We're speaking with Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, and joining me on the phone is Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. And Chris, I want to move over to last week's visit by the President of the United States back to a homecoming back to Springfield, and talking about kind of a valedictory type address of regretting that he couldn't do more to bridge the gap between the parties in the way that he felt Springfield used to work. And of course, we're seeing Springfield totally not working right now. But I thought it was interesting. One of the more interesting moments was when he called out Democratic State Representative Ken Duncan of Chicago. Duncan, who has been siding with Governor Bruce Rauner, the Republican, on votes and denying the Democrats their 71-vote majority. I want to play this clip.
I think sometimes my Republican colleagues make constructive points about outdated regulations that may need to be changed, or programs that, even though well-intended, didn't always work the way they were supposed to. And where I've got an opportunity to find some common ground, that doesn't make me a sellout to my own party. That applies, now,
The same. Well, we'll talk later, Duncan. You just see him.
That was a great moment, wasn't it?
Yeah, poor Ken Duncan, who happens to be my state rep. He was instigated by he himself cheering out, at that moment, saying, because he was thinking that was a validation for himself. And but the fact that the president says, yes, you shouldn't be a sellout, but then he sort of chastises mildly the guy that did cross party lines, really the one guy who has crossed party lines in this whole situation, demonstrates the sort of natural tension in this whole kind of situation. When you're talking about, well, on the one hand, we value idealism and principle discussion, and on the other hand, it can get in the way. We love compromise, especially if the other guy compromises to come over to our side, right? That just shows the wisdom of this person. But then our person compromising with the other side becomes vilified as a sellout or as a traitor and so forth. So it's a natural tension. It goes back, as the president pointed out, it's not new. It goes back, to the founding of the Republic. It's one of the problems with democracy. One of the many problems with democracy is that, we have different points of view, and they're difficult to reconcile. We don't live in it's not a government of philosopher kings, right?
Well, and I still wonder what the real point of the visit was, other than just kind of, I'm in my final year, and here are some of my thoughts. I sure don't think it changes anything in Springfield.
Well, I think it was clear that it wasn't about Springfield. I mean, it wasn't. It was a prop, right? He gives his budget address, and then they do this. Governors do this, presidents do this. You have a message, and then you go out and find places to express this message, both to solidify it and to broadcast it. And here he is in Springfield. I think, it meant something for him, and it was a good prop for him in the sense that this is the way things, used to be. We would work together and we'd play poker and we'd disagree, but we'd get things done. And I would work with, Kirk Dillard, and everything was good in the end after a tough battle. The problem for the president is that it's not exactly the perfect prop at the moment.
No.
Because of the ongoing situation here. But, people around the country, what do they know about our budget situation? I mean, to some extent, it's known around the country, but not that much. And, so I think it was an uncomfortable choice for the president to some extent, but it still made the point he was trying to make, and that he wanted to be a unifier. He's always said that, and it never quite worked out that way. I don't think for great fault of his own, frankly. I think the president really faced incredible vitriol from the right, and he was more of a centrist. I think the left didn't think too much of him either. So
that's Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Chris, thanks very much for joining me this morning.
My pleasure, Rick. Have a good one.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Martha Jo Black, author of Joe Black, More Than a Dodger, John Byrne, a member of the Chicago Tribune's political team, and Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Most of all, though, I want to thank all of you for listening and putting up with my cold and my kind of nasal inflection. And now I'm going, speaking of nasal inflection.
Hey, wait a minute.
Wasn't that the band you used to play in, Dean?
I did used to be.
Yes.
I was the bass player with those guys for many years. Well, this was going to be a big Valentine's Day show, but the events of the last 12 hours or so have taken the show in a completely different direction now.
Well, and I have to tell you, I learned of it from Twitter, of course, and I just went, holy cow, this is going to change things an awful lot.
It is. The political ramifications of this, I think, are incredibly interesting. I found the coverage last night of his death also very, very interesting, depending on what you were watching last night. We'll talk about all of that. and so much more. It's going to be a busy Sunday morning around here. Feel better, Rick?
Happy Valentine's Day.
Oh, thought you'd forget.